First case on our calendar, 07-1588, Robert Thornton versus Montville Plastics and Rubber, Inc. Mr. Willacy.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Associate Justices, good morning. My name is Aubrey Willacy, and it is my honor to represent Montville Plastics and Rubber, Inc., whose president, Don Hofstetter, and whose secretary treasurer, Teresa Hofstetter, are here in court with me this morning. There are two points which I urge the justices to take with them when you sit down to deliberate upon this case. The first point is a public policy concept. That concept is that time is of the essence in workers' compensation appeals under revised code 4123.512. The second concept is that because the employer's consent provision in revised code 4123.512D, because that provision is purely procedural, that is to say remedial in nature, there is no impediment whatsoever to applying that provision to cases which incepted before its effective date. Going back to the time is of the essence concept, what really is at issue in this case is the General Assembly's most recent legislative reiteration of the concept that time is of the essence in workers' compensation appeals, and thus that unnecessary delay in the determination of such cases at the trial court level is not to be tolerated. That is the public policy reason which underlies Section 512D's employer consent amendment. That amendment is merely an anti-delay provision. Significantly, our courts have routinely ignored the concept that time is of the essence in workers' compensation appeals, even though it has long been the statutory law of this case. A little personal reference is necessary. I started practicing law in 1970. At that time, the first area of practice that I went into was workers' compensation, then known as workmen's compensation. The appeal statute then was revised code 4123.519, since renumbered as 512 and slightly amended since then. Yet and still, the 1970 version of the appeal statute contained this provision in exactly the same words which are present in the current statute. All actions and proceedings under this section, which are the subject of an appeal to the Court of Common Pleas or the Court of Appeals, shall be preferred over all other civil actions except election causes, irrespective of position on the calendar. Now, to the best of my knowledge, it was not until May 20th of this year that this court itself recognized the fact that delay in the adjudication of 512 appeals is antithetical to the administration of justice and, quote, inherently injurious, close quote, to the parties affected thereby. This court so held in Disciplinary Counsel versus Sargent, 118 Ohio State 3rd, 322, 2008 Ohio 2330, at paragraphs 19 to 21, 29 to 30, and 34. That, of course, was a disciplinary case, and it seems quite significant to me that that this court saw fit to sanction a fellow jurist for permitting unnecessary delay in the adjudication of a workers' compensation matter, among other things. That was, of course, not the sole charge brought against Judge Sargent. As I see it, the statutory expression of that public policy concept is not only what requires this court to adopt Montville's view regarding the merits in this case, as set forth in our proposition of law number one, by reversing the lower court's contralegal decisions and entering final judgment in Montville's favor upon this appeal, but that statutory expression of the public policy concept also answers the subsidiary issue of whether the trial court's October 31, 2006 judgment in this special proceeding was a final appealable order under both revised code 2505.02B1 and 2505.02B2. The right to a speedy adjudication in workers' compensation appeals being a substantial right, as substantial right is defined in 2505.02A1, it makes it pretty clear to understand how a trial court's order, which sanctioned and upheld a claimant's unilateral voluntary dismissal after 512D's amendment took effect, affected the employer's substantial right to have a prompt adjudication of its appeal. Now, in this case, the record clearly shows how time equates to money. Every year of delay in the adjudication of Montville's appeal to the trial court, costing it more than $100,000 due to the Bureau of Workers' Compensation's mirror reserving system's impact upon Montville's eligibility for group rating savings. That fact is not disputed by either appellee. It's also worth noting, moving on to the second point, that a plaintiff's so-called right to unilaterally dismiss without prejudice and later refile exists only because Civil Rule 41A1, which is a rule of the Ohio Rules of Civil Procedure, and I would emphasize, italicize, and underscore the word procedure, only because the Civil Rule 41A1 affords it. That is to say, it is simply a procedural right, not a substantive right. Now, that a procedural right can be legislatively afforded, changed, limited, or removed by the General Assembly while a case is pending is unquestionable. And insofar as Section 4123.512D's employer consent provision is concerned, that is simply what the General Assembly did.
What is the legal impact, then, of the notice of dismissal that was filed by the employee in this instance?
He had no right to file it. The legal impact of it should have been nothing at all, Judge O'Donnell, but Justice O'Donnell, excuse me.
Thanks.
What the trial court, what the problem is not that Mr. Stern, on behalf of Mr. Thornton, filed the notice of dismissal. The problem is that the trial court endorsed his approval upon it, accepted it, and effectuated it by taking the case off the trial calendar and effectively closing the case, in fact, closing the case.
But the Court of Appeals picked up on the self-actuating effect of a notice of dismissal, not the trial court's recognition.
Understood, but the court
of a judgment.
I'm sorry, I understand exactly where you're going, so please forgive me for talking across you. I did not mean to do so. In so doing, the Court of Appeals gave effect to a filing which the General Assembly had said is a nullity. And that's why I believe this court accepted jurisdiction, or one of the reasons that this court accepted jurisdiction.
So
Appeals ruling had been correct in that regard, from a procedural perspective, this court would not have had a final order.
To get to where you want the outcome to be, do we have to declare the action of the trial court a nullity or the action of the employee in filing the notice of dismissal a nullity?
The action of the trial court was a nullity. The action of the employee in precipitating that, I believe, was equivalent to a Siegfried abandonment of the claim. How else can we characterize it? Where the legislature says you don't have the right to do it, and someone does it anyway. How else can you characterize it? When, of course, the plaintiff in any civil matter always has the right to withdraw from the fight, to withdraw from the contest. He always has the right to abandon his claim. And that is the only option that the legislature left when it adopted 512D.
So, Mr. Willacy, looking at it a little bit differently, the specific provision for the workers' comp cases in 4123.512D overrides the usual 41A dismissal. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because we have to think again of policy. First, the employer who is being charged $100,000, who's losing, $100,000 a year for every year of delay in the adjudication of its appeal certainly has the right to have that appeal promptly adjudicated. Now, when the claimant interferes with that right by throwing in delay contrary to legislative command, I don't think he can do so with impunity. The 41A, resort to 41A was only made possible because the legislature said in 512 and formerly in 519 that the rules of civil procedure are to apply to workers' compensation matters. It's not because the courts said so, but because the legislature so directed. This is a special statutory proceeding. The legislature, certainly being the one that has the power to give, also has the power to do what? Taketh away. And that's what they did in 512D. There is no inherent right, substantive right, to dismiss without prejudice and then refile. 2305.19 gives you the right to refile if there has been a failure otherwise than upon the merits. Here, the legislature in 512D has said this type of, there is no such thing anymore as a failure otherwise than upon the merits by resort to Civil Rule 41A1 in these cases, in employer appeal cases.
Counsel, just so I understand, are you saying that the voluntary dismissal was a nullity, so that the case should still be pending, or are you saying the voluntary dismissal, in effect, was a dismissal with prejudice?
I'm saying the voluntary dismissal was, in effect, a dismissal with prejudice because the only right of dismissal which Mr. Stern and his client had was to dismiss with prejudice if they were going to do it on a unilateral basis. So by filing a notice of dismissal, even though they put in the words without prejudice, it's with prejudice, just as a second voluntary dismissal in any other civil case that uses the words without prejudice is viewed in the law as being a dismissal with prejudice.
Counsel, I thought you argued earlier that the filing was a nullity.
The filing was a nullity in the sense of terminating the action without prejudice.
Okay, if it's a nullity, then if you get the outcome you want, aren't you right back at the level of an appeal that is still alive and well?
I don't believe so unless someone is going to restore to Montville, either the Bureau or Mr. Thornton, the $100,000 or $200,000 at this juncture.
I realize that it doesn't get you where you want to be, but if you're arguing that the filing was a nullity, then you're right back to where you were when it was filed. I want to follow up on your argument that the legislature can change the rules of procedure and that is undisputed. I'm not understanding that. I thought this court had exclusive control of the rules of procedure. And let me give you, you're arguing that since workers' comp is a statutory action, that the court can give and take away on procedural grounds. Would the same then be true of wrongful death, which is also a statutory procedure or a statutory cause of action, that they could change the rules of procedure as they see fit?
Justice Pfeiffer, with all due respect, I don't understand the parallel that you were drawing. I don't understand
question. Workers' comp, you said, is statutory.
Yes, sir.
Statutory cause of action. And therefore, the legislature can say the rules of civil procedure apply or don't apply, even though this court has exclusive authority over the rules of civil procedure.
Yes.
Then the same argument would apply to wrongful death actions because those are statutory.
The procedure in wrongful death actions, and I'm not that well versed with that particular statute at this juncture, the procedure in wrongful death actions is, as far as I have ever known, simply that which the civil rules have provided. not because the legislature says so.
And that's the same as any other
but
case.
But in workers' compensation matters, revised code 4123.512 specifies that after the filing of the plaintiff's petition, not complaint as such, but petition.
Okay. My question is how
matter then shall proceed as, under the civil rules.
Okay, but my question is how does the legislature trump the Constitution?
Because the Constitution gives the legislature, Article 2, Section 35, gives the legislature the power to set the terms and conditions upon which payments from the state insurance fund shall be made. That is a power which the Constitution does not confer upon this court, nor the judiciary. That's an Article 2 power, not an Article, 3 power?
Okay.
Thank you. My time has expired. I had intended to reserve some for rebuttal, but neglected to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Willacy. Mr. Stern.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mitchell Stern, and I represent Robert Thornton in this matter.
Counsel, could I ask you a question? If we agree that the legislation from August 25, 2006 is prospective only in its application, is there anything else to resolve here?
No, Your Honor, there is not. The cause of action, if it's prospective in nature, then there's really nothing more to decide. I will speak for 5 minutes and turn the balance of the argument over to Assistant Attorney General Elise Porter. There are 2 points that I would like to make, and it's to refocus the attention on the specific issue before the court, and that is, did the Court of Appeals, when it dismissed Montville's notice of appeal sua sponte, did the court err in that decision? It did not for 2 reasons. First, a notice of voluntary dismissal filed pursuant to Civil Rule 41A1A is not a final appealable order. Second, the filing of a notice of voluntary dismissal is self-executing. Therefore, even if this court should find that it is a final appealable order, the appeal was not timely filed. A filing of a notice of voluntary dismissal is not an order in the sense that it is not an adjudication on the merits, citing the Hensley versus Henry case. It is not a final and appealable order because it does not satisfy those requirements as set forth under Section 250502.
Do you agree that the legislature has the power to set the parameters of what that voluntary dismissal can be like under statute?
I believe that there are limitations as set forth under 41A1A.
Are you challenging whether the requirement that the employer sign off on the voluntary dismissal is not within their power to do so?
It is within their power to do so.
So your argument is only then whether it applies to your client or not by the timing?
That is correct.
So let's assume that once the law goes into effect, let's take the position that we rule against you on procedure and the timeliness and whether it applies. In other words, that it does apply to your client because of the timing issues. Does it then allow your client still to file a voluntary dismissal, or do you, after the act becomes effective, have to have the consent of the employer?
If I understand your question correctly, I do not need the consent of the employer if the cause of action arose prior to the effective date of the amendment.
Let's say we decide that against you.
I understand. Okay.
Then, if you file a voluntary dismissal without the employer, does that violate the requirements of the statute?
Yes.
And then how does one appeal that? If you file a voluntary dismissal without the employer, how does one appeal that issue?
There are several avenues. And that is actually set forth in a couple of the cases that are pending before this court. You have the Vasquez case, in which a claimant filed a writ of prohibition because the trial court did not accept the voluntary dismissal. From the employer's side, if the court does accept the voluntary dismissal, it has a right to file a mandamus action. the Marin case, which is also pending
before
this
court.
So you can't,
in your opinion, if they file a voluntary dismissal in violation of the statute, let's put aside the issue of whether it applies or not.
Okay.
You maintain that that is never an appealable order. You have to use another avenue to contest it.
That is correct.
Okay.
The second point being that the filing is self-executing, in that Rule 41A specifically states that a plaintiff without order of court may dismiss all claims, without order of court.
Again, on your second point, if the statute applies, does that become self-executing?
Then we have a conflict between what the legislature did in adding the employer approval language and the plain language of Civil Rule 41A1A. And that, although that issue is not before us, may exceed the powers of the legislature, because again, under 4123.512, that statute specifically states that following the filing of a complaint, you go by the rules of civil procedure in a workers' compensation appeal to Common Pleas Court. And if the rules of civil procedure permit that filing, then, or a self-executing dismissal, then that addendum or that addition to the statute may exceed the legislature's authority.
But doesn't the legislature have the power in the first place to say, and they did say, rules of civil procedure apply after this stage? And if they say that, why can't they say something differently? They are the ones that gave us the authority after a case has been filed by a plaintiff to go under the rules of civil procedure. And as you know, I strongly dissented when we applied the 41A dismissal one-year saving statute. I've been on record for a long time as opposing that as not applicable. So I'm on record for that. You know my position on that. But they said in statute, now you go by the rules of civil procedure, so why can't they by statute say, okay, now we're changing what applies under the rules of civil procedure, because they gave it to us in the first place?
Then it boils down to this court's interpretation of whether it could be retroactively applied or not. I am out of time. Thank you very much.
May I ask you, before I ask Ms. Porter to come, what's your view of the separate concurrence in the Court of Appeals opinions by Judge Trapp? Are you familiar with it?
I'm at a blank. I'm
right.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Porter.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, just to get one thing straight, under no set of facts, under any interpretation, can you say that in this case, the case arose after the effective date of the statute that's at issue here. So the facts of this case, well, we have to assume we're going under the previous law if, in fact, you interpret the case, or interpret, I'm sorry, the statute to be prospective only. That being said, the core analysis here is whether or not this is a final, whether or not a voluntary dismissal is a final appealable order, as has been stated before. And under Revised Code 2505.02, probably the most, the closest you would get to making it a final appealable order would be under B2, which requires that you have a special proceeding and that you be affecting a substantial right. As this court held in Arrington, a workers' compensation 512 appeal is a special statutory proceeding. So you have that part of the analysis. The question then is, does it affect a substantial right? And again, as has been already argued, we feel that a voluntary dismissal is self-executing. So what was a nullity was not the voluntary dismissal by Mr. Thornton, but the court's journalizing it was, I wouldn't say it was a nullity, but it was legally unimportant. It wasn't anything to appeal from. It didn't have any effect. If the court hadn't done anything, it would still have been a voluntary dismissal.
I'll ask you the same question then. If we assume the statute does apply, let's just make that assumption.
Okay.
And you have a voluntary dismissal without the employer consent.
Correct.
Is that a final appealable order then?
I don't know that it would be a final appealable order. I think it would have the effect that Mr. Willacy said. It would actually be a dismissal with prejudice rather than without prejudice.
Okay, so you were at least agreement with him that
correct.
If you file without their consent, then you have abandoned your claim.
If the new statute applies
to
your
statute
case,
applies.
Yes, then
okay.
then you can't
so you
do
don't
that
have to
anymore, and that's in effect and dismissal with prejudice.
And you essentially don't have to worry about the final appealable order.
You don't have to worry about it because the case is over, and actually the court wouldn't have jurisdiction. The question then is, what is a substantial? Well, I guess the first question, before you even get to whether or not you have a substantial right, is whether or not there was a court order here. And because the court's journalization or order was really had no legal effect, I think you could argue that there was no order at all. Even assuming that that's an order, then you have to have a substantial right, and that's a right that a person is entitled to enforce in some way or another. That requires the analysis then to at least provisionally look at the merits here, which is whether or not Senate Bill 7 is applied retroactively here or solely prospectively. And in this case, I do want to strongly disagree with something Mr. Willacy said, and that is he said there was no impediment to applying the case retroactively. That's not true. There may not be a constitutional impediment, but there certainly is a legislative impediment, and that is the actual words of the legislature in black and white. This act applies to all claims arising on and after the effective date of this act.
That's section 3 of the
That's section 3 of the uncodified part of Senate Bill 7. That is clear intent from the General Assembly that all of the provisions, and this is one of many, many amendments to various different workers' comp laws, that were made prospective only. And in addition to that, just to emphasize the point, they made one exception, and that's subsection H of section 512. So by making an exception and saying, by the way, subsection H is retroactive, they were emphasizing even more that they wanted it to be applied prospectively. Not only did they want it to be applied prospectively, but they wanted it to be applied prospectively only to claims that arose on or after the effective date. In other words, not claims that were pending on the effective date of the act. So the General Assembly was very clear in its legislative language what it intended. No one has brought up any other impediments, so to speak, to treating this as a prospective law, starting with cases that arise on or after the effective date of the statute. And again, as I said, if you look at the timeline of this particular case, the facts here, there's no argument that you can make that this case arose on or after the effective date. The injury occurred in 2005. Again, the case law generally says that workers' compensation cases arise on the date of injury. But even if you were to argue that the case arose on the date the appeal was filed on March 1st, 2006. The earliest possible effective date for this statute is June 30th, 2006, well after the date that the case was filed. It's therefore impossible, under any reasonable argument, that this case could be affected by the new statute.
What do we do about the fact that the Court of Appeals opinion doesn't discuss this issue?
That's correct.
No,
it doesn't,
they decided totally on interpretation of the rule, the statute. And then Judge Trapp had a different view of how the effect of filing a voluntary motion is, and the court's order essentially accepting the motion. But there's nothing in the Court of Appeals opinion on the issue that's before us, is there?
There's not, Your Honor. But the problem with it is, if you go through the analysis, I think what was happening was the Court of Appeals was simply assuming one state of the law or the other, whether it was a self-executing or not. We don't know whether it's self-executing yet, because we have to at least provisionally look at the merits of the retroactivity question to determine whether or not that voluntary dismissal was self-executing.
There isn't even an assignment of error listed in the Court of Appeals opinion. Usually, Court of Appeals opinions indicate what the assignment of error is.
That's correct.
This opinion doesn't even have that.
That's correct. One thing
it's not your problem. I'm just observing that here we are with another case in which the Court of Appeals has simply given us a ball and asked us to twine and asked us to do something with it. And a little difficult under our rules and our usual practice when we're supposed to decide issues of public importance, and we have a Court of Appeals opinion like this. So,
that's correct, Your Honor.
We won't take off your time for this.
Oh,
lecture.
That's okay. but what I might mention is that the court has held three other cases that have this core retroactivity issue as part of them, in which the court could reach the issue that way as well. One of which, Vasquez, which is the a prohibition case, which was mentioned earlier, has already been fully briefed. So if the court found it difficult to reach the issue here, you could go to Vasquez or the other case, Morin.
Well, following up on the Chief's question, then, what specifically do you believe should be the holding of this court? An affirm on other grounds?
I think you would have to do that, yes, either affirm or reverse on other grounds, Your Honor, yes. I think.
Or we could improvidently allow it.
Or improvidently allow and accept either Vasquez or Morin, in which you could look at the issue, the underlying retroactivity issue, in a cleaner case. Yes. I see my time is just about.
Well, you can take some more time if you'd like.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I guess the one other thing I wanted to mention, Justice Pfeiffer had asked about special statutory proceeding. A special statutory proceeding is a cause of action that didn't exist at common law. One other issue, and as this court held in Arrington, workers' compensation appeals did not exist at common law, and that's how we get to the whether or not the legislature can constitutionally fiddle with the rules of procedure in this case.
And you think they can?
I do believe they can. If you look at Civil Rule C-1, it talks about it where you have a case of special statutory proceeding, which the court has held that these types of proceedings are, then the legislature can either apply the civil rules or apply them partway or not apply them, however they want to do. And that's exactly what they've done here, is modified one civil rule in this very specialized area of civil cases.
Now you've used your time, Ms. Porter.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Willisie, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm amazed at the appellee's assertion that the uncodified Section 3 sweeps away the other provisions in 512H, as enacted by the 126th General Assembly in amended substitute Senate Bill 7, that also deal with the question of retroactivity or prospectivity. She cites to a provision in the uncodified section that deals with workers' compensation claims. I would refer this court, as I have briefed exhaustively at both court levels now, to the provisions of 4123.512H, the timing provisions, the effective date provisions, which speak of court cases, which is what we're dealing with here. We're not dealing with a workers' compensation claim at this juncture. We're dealing with a workers' compensation appeal in the Court of Common Pleas. And there is a specific provision in there which says this statute applies to all appeals that were pending after, if I remember correctly, it's either November 1, 1959 or sometime in 1986. Those are the provisions that apply to this case, not the uncodified Section 3 provision to which appellees so feverishly latch on to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Willisie. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.